Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, do you have a pool going with other reporters as to when a verdict will come in?
I think we've tried to stay professional and not. And it's really hard to tell. It's really hard to tell. Based on the jury notes that I've seen so far, I think it's going to be a few days.
WNYC's
at least
Lisa Chow, economics reporter, blogging the Bear Stearns trial. So that was just yesterday on the show with WNYC's Lisa Chow, staying professional and not offering a prediction on when a verdict would be reached in the Bear Stearns trial. But lo and behold, a mere 5 hours later, there was a verdict, timing that no one outside of the jury room apparently saw coming. So Lisa's back with us now, not so that we can crow about her missed prediction, but to tie a ribbon on her coverage of the trial. She has a much-deserved vacation day today, but has agreed to join us for just a few minutes. And if you haven't heard, the Bear Stearns 2 got off, accused by the federal government of lying to investors about how bad their subprime mortgage-based hedge funds were doing in 2007. Jurors like Ryan Goolsbee decided that the defendants engaged in salesmanship, not fraud.
Well, it was really fraud. That's what we were looking at. And what were these statements meant fraudulently? Like, is that what they were trying to, were they trying to deceive investors in terms to make gains for themselves? And we just did not see that.
They did not see the fraud. So, Lisa Chow, are you surprised at the verdict? Or the timing, the swiftness of it?
I was very surprised at the swiftness of it, clearly. I don't know if I was surprised. I guess I was more surprised in talking to the jurors about their reasons. One juror told me that at the very beginning, during opening arguments, she thought the defendants were guilty. And she changed her mind over the course of the 4 weeks. So there was clearly a shift. And another juror told me that he didn't like the way the government used select quotes from emails, that he thought that, you know, if you read anyone's email, you could probably have these gotcha moments all over the place, and he thought it was unfair. So it was interesting, actually, to get their views on the case after these 4 weeks.
You know, we didn't talk much yesterday about the jurors themselves, but I gather from reading elsewhere that they were largely from working class backgrounds. Did they put people from Wall Street on a pedestal? Did they have to get over bias against them? I guess that you indicated that one juror came in assuming guilty. Do you think there was a class thing going on?
The jurors I spoke to, one was a social worker, one was a woman who worked with needy high school kids, another was a manager in a hotel, someone else was processing images for Christie's art auction house. It was really a variety of different types of professions and different backgrounds. There were 8 women in the jury, 4 men. The women were extremely sympathetic to the defendants. I think that was a little bit surprising to me, to be honest, but they were. And I don't know how much was influenced by just the defendants being there every day, their families being there every day. There were moments where the two men did break up a little bit in terms of emotionally, I mean, let out a few tears, and I spoke yesterday about how the lawyer for one of the defendants also cried, and the jurors mentioned that to me, that that was one of the most surprising moments for them during the trial. I mean, they also said that they tried to not let that influence their decision and that they were looking purely at the evidence.
They also said they were not letting the fact that we're in a deep recession color their view of the evidence. And I guess you really got to admire the American justice system for instilling the jurors with the willingness and the values to try to do that and just look at the facts.
Right, right. I think that, you know, I talked to a former federal prosecutor yesterday after the verdict, and, you know, he says the assumption by prosecutors to think that big, massive investor losses and this wanting to go after these fat cat executives is not necessarily going to lead to convictions, and that defense attorneys, their fear about this may not be completely founded either.
WNYC's Lisa Chow off to a well-deserved vacation. Lisa, thanks a lot.
And thanks, Brian.
People can still see all of Lisa's blogging of the Bear Stearns trial from her days in the courtroom as well as her pieces at WNYC.org. With us now is William Cohan, contributing editor at Fortune, former Wall Street banker and author of the book House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris, and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. William Cohan, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Nice to be here.
Are you surprised at this verdict? Do you agree with it?
I have to say I'm surprised by the swiftness of it as well, but I'm not surprised at the verdict itself because I think the prosecution miscalculated, and Lisa was absolutely right, and she's talking about the way they selectively used emails to, you know, portions from these emails to make their case. And I think if you read the whole email, which of course I have and I quote from in my book, you'll see that it's much more ambiguous. There's a lot of ambiguity in what Matthew Tenine was writing, and that, you know, obviously put in the juror's mind a lot of reasonable doubt, which I guess is the system and what should happen.
Is the line between salesmanship and fraud the issue? Is the line gray? Is the line moving as a result of this verdict?
You know, there's a lot of spinning on Wall Street. There's a lot of salesmanship on Wall Street. I mean, Wall Street is nothing more than a huge sales force and sales army. And, you know, Matthew Tenine and Ralph Joffe were in the business of selling investors on the wisdom of these hedge funds and getting them to, first of all, invest, and then after they had performed well for 40 months and started to crack in the spring of 2007, their mission was to keep them from redeeming from the hedge funds. And, you know, I guess, you know, there were all sophisticated investors here, and I think that's probably what the jury, you know, concluded, that, you know, that these people, you know, were smart enough to know better and weren't going to hold these two guys to blame. In fact,
one jury
said that.
Go ahead.
Well, one jury said that at the end, that, you know, there was a big, wide crisis here, and we're not going to blame these two guys for it.
There are still charges pending against them from the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, as well as civil suits by individual investors, aren't there?
Yes, and this is, of course, but these guys are by no means out of the woods. Maybe what they did wasn't criminal in the end, but, you know, upwards of $1.6 billion was lost by investors, and I can assure you there's a lot of evidence that came out of this trial that investors will use to go after these guys, and I'm sure the SEC will use to go after these guys. So,
like, you know, what? I mean, is there a different standard of proof or a different standard of behavior in those actions for a guilty verdict?
Yes, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, of course, but I mean, this beyond a reasonable doubt is a high standard. There are lower standards for civil suits. There are suits, you know, from people who invested through the Cayman Islands against these guys. There are suits in arbitration against them. There's the SEC suit. I mean, and for instance, I think there was plenty of evidence that the government could have used. Again, I don't know whether it was criminal, but, you know, there's this sort of what I refer to as the smoking gun memo that Bear Stearns management put forth in June of 2007. There was a memo that was typed up in black and white. It was introduced sort of vaguely into the courtroom, but never much was made of it, where the Bear Stearns management was worried about what was going to happen when investors started asking about what kinds of things the hedge funds had invested in. And they typed up a memo, and they sent it around to the brokers who had interacted with investors. And in this memo, they said, we're going to get asked about what kinds of securities the hedge funds were invested in. What were they? And the memo's response was, this is how you should answer. Well, even though everybody thought it was a minimal amount of subprime mortgages, it turned out to be 60% of subprime mortgages. And that was, you know, huge piece of information that investors hadn't known about before. And, you know, Joffe and Tenine never at all explained that to their investors. In fact, they had always been misleading the investors, thinking that it was closer to 6% invested in subprime mortgages instead of 60. So I'm surprised not more was made out of that, but
all right.
That's not me.
Well, not guilty in federal court yesterday, but not out of the woods yet. Tenine
exactly.
And Joffe, formerly from Bear Stearns. William Cohan, contributing editor at Fortune, author of House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris, and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we go from that to the effects of the crash on non-Wall Street ordinary folks and what's hot and what's not in the job market in our area right now. Stay with us.